Blog Talk Radio.
I'm Rich Ferguson, L.A. poet, musician, performer, and you are listening to Poet Escape. Welcome, everyone. Today, I am very pleased to have as my guest the crazy, sick, talented, and multifaceted Beth Lissick. How are you, Beth?
I'm great, Rich. How are you doing?
Doing well. Thanks for being on the show. Beth Lissick is a writer and actor. She's the author of 5 books, the memoir collection Yokohama Three-Way and Other Small Shames, the New York Times best-selling comic memoir Everybody Into the Pool, the Gonzo Self-Help Manifesto, Helping Me Help Myself. The story collection This Too Can Be Yours and the performance poetry story collection Monkey Girl. Her recent projects include Tell You What, a series of chapbooks made with the artists at Creativity Explored with a grant from the Creative Work Fund and Rods and Cones, a comedy series she co-wrote and co-stars in with Tara Jepsen. In 2002, she created the Porchlight storytelling series with Arlene Klatt, a monthly storytelling show in San Francisco. Her acting credits include leading roles in Frasier Bradshaw's Everything Strange and New, which won the Fipresky Critics Prize, was nominated for the Spirit and Gotham Awards and screened at Sundance, and Joey Izzo's Stepsister, which screened at San Francisco International and Cannes in 2013. A native of the Bay Area, Beth currently lives in Brooklyn. Wow, Beth, that was a mouthful, a very tasty mouthful.
Oh.
You've done so much, and that's actually kind of sort of a point that I want to get at in today's show. I mean, it's sort of a...
You want to talk about my ADHD?
I want this show to serve as, to some degree, a Beth Lissick sampler, you know, because you've accomplished so much, you've done so many different things, and I want to try to talk about as many of them as possible, if that's cool with you.
Of course.
Okay, cool. You know, you've performed spoken word at Lollapalooza, you've played in garage rock bands, you've been on This American Life, written numerous books. You know, but from where I'm sitting, you know, no matter what you've accomplished, one through line that I see that runs through so much of your work is your sense of humor. You know, you're funny on the page, on stage, and in person. How would you say you've developed your sense of humor, and why would you say it's important to share that with others in your work?
Oh, man. I mean, I never thought that I was funny. You know, when I was growing up and stuff, I didn't think of myself as a particularly funny person. But I think that, I don't know. When I started writing, this is after I got out of college, I didn't really start writing until after I was out of college. And when I started doing open mics, I just realized that the stuff that came out and stuff that I wanted to point out was sort of what people would laugh, you know, at a lot of it. And so I think that in that way I realized, because I was always kind of, I didn't grow up with any artists or any creative at all, and I didn't understand how anybody could even feel confident enough to think that they could contribute a voice, you know, to the world. Like, I didn't get that, you know, and so when I was at an open mic and started seeing people getting up there doing stuff, I just thought, well, I'm just going to try to, you know, write something that's short and, you know, that will be entertaining and just see how it goes. And so I think that, you know, the first things that I wrote were mostly funny things that were, you know, a little dark at times or a little, you know, weird. And I think that it maybe it's the impulse that a lot of comedians have where you hear that response And, you know, that, like, laughing is a lot more tangible of a response, I think, than people being, like, deeply, like, the deeply affected sigh or moan. And if you're writing something very heavy and deep and profound, you know, it's like, whoa, what's the sound of a room, you know, being really compelled in a deep spiritual way. But then you hear laughter and you're like, oh, all right, that's the way of you know, making people entertained and, you know, getting something out there. So I think it just was, you know, by having that sensibility in the first place and then finding that, that with audiences, it was really fun to see if I could write things that would, you know, that people would, that would make people laugh. Things I thought were funny, and it was great when other people thought they were funny too.
Yeah. You mentioned comedians before. Are there any comedians that, I don't want to say studied, but are there any comedians that you've looked at either for timing or subject matter or anything like that, that you're just like, yeah, you know, that I want a little bit of that?
Well, I think early on, like now it's funny, it's hard for me. It's hard to watch a lot of people or listen to a lot of people or read a lot of people when you're in the middle of working on stuff. Like I mean, I'm always reading a book, but I feel like I don't necessarily read the types of books that I write. And I think the same with humor. It's like, I mean, I do, like, I remember really being affected by Anne Magnuson and Bongwater and Sandra Bernhardt, Without You, I'm Nothing, the one woman show she did, and just really seeing, like, wow, it's just this one lady and her weird, you know, thoughts and what you can get up there on stage and do. And so I think early on they were definitely people that I was inspired by. And more recently, I love Amy Sedaris, and I love her weird take on things. And I've interviewed her a couple times on stage, and, you know, she's just the most polite, sweet, you know, just kind of really mellow person, and then when she's performing, she just, you know, she just becomes this other person, and that that's really cool to see too. To see that it's like she's not some power josher who's always like trying to be a clown, you know. And so I like that too, because it's like, whoa, in what part of your like pretty head is there some crazy person, Amy Sedaris, you know? And so that you know, that's, she's definitely an inspiration.
Do you feel that you have that aspect of that sort of other person when you get on stage to perform, or do you feel it's more organic and you're sort of, you know, the you off stage is a lot like you, the you that is on stage?
I think more it's I'm more like myself on stage now than I used to be. I mean, but maybe I was a little bit different then too. Like in my 20s, like mid-20s, when I started performing, doing spoken word stuff, like I was really kind of angsty and spastic, and I can be that way in person too. I've definitely gotten a little bit more mellow as I've gotten older, but I've always felt a need to be, like, if I'm telling a story or reading something, just to be as close to who I am as possible. And I think there are other people, and there's some of the comedy stuff I do where I'm a completely different character or acting or whatever. But I think that if I'm reading for my own work, I just try to be as much of myself as I can. You know, I've never had like a persona that I do things under.
Yeah.
It's just always felt like, well, my name is Beth Lissick. I'm going to keep it that way. I'm going to set the stage name and word, here we go, you know.
Right. Have you ever written any dead-on serious pieces, or would you say with even, you know, even with serious subject matter that you've still at times used humor as a way to even approach dark, serious subject matter?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's a few pieces in my new book that are darker and more serious, but if you look in there, I think that even if it's just a phrase or something that's, it's almost, I guess the thing where the humor comes into me, which is part of my humor, is, you know, if something is just kind of twisted and weird, it's funny, but also a little dark and disturbing, but you know, so there are definitely some more serious pieces in the book that I have now, but I think that there's probably at least one word in there that is just a word that makes me laugh or something, you know, that just always comes out.
Right. Well, speaking of your latest book, Yokohama Three-Way and Other Small Shames by City Lights Publishers. Well done, City Lights. That's very cool.
Yeah, that's exciting for me.
Yeah, I bet. I would like it if you could sort of tell the listeners what the collection is about, and I would love it if you could tell the story about how you discovered the idea for the book and how you came up with the shames that you wanted to write about.
I was I had written that book, Helping Me Help Myself, which was sort of one of those year in the life of trying to do self-help programs. And so I wanted that to be, you know, I thought, okay, this is a crazy topic. This will be really fun. And as I was writing that book, I felt like, okay, it's too easy to make fun of these people. So I have to, you know, I'm really going to try to do this stuff. And so I felt like that book just didn't come out as funny as I wanted it to, because I couldn't. I couldn't make it funny in parts because it was like I was really trying to do this self-improvement work, which can make you feel terrible about yourself, which is funny, of course, in the end. But,
yeah, funny.
But as I was writing it, I just felt like overly serious about it. And I didn't even want to make fun of some of these like billionaire self-help gurus, because then I would meet people who would be like, God, I was, you know, an alcoholic and I filed for bankruptcy. And I, you know, and then I learned about just trying to, you know, the 7 habits of highly effective people. And I really turned my life around, you know, so I was meeting people whose lives had been changed. And anyway, so after I finished that book, I was like, forget it. I'm not writing about my stupid life ever again. I feel like such a clown trying to be all, take this so seriously. And I started writing a novel. And then as I was writing the novel, I was like, you know, goodbye forever to memoir stuff. And then I almost went through this weird mourning phase where I was, because I had always, from doing spoken word stuff and, you know, drawn from my life and told stories from my life. So I was like, God, I never wrote about the Yokohama Three-Way. You know, I never wrote about the, you know, Winnebago incident. Like, I never wrote about, you know, the dog towel fiasco and, like, all these things that in my mind had built up as these, like, horrible moments of shame and embarrassment and regret and false pride or hubris or just, like, actually really important moments in my life. So I was on a plane from San Francisco to New York, and I decided to see if I could just make a list of all of those things that I'd never written about in all my years of writing that were actually the things that I really did define myself by. And so I made this list, and by the time I landed, I had like 60-something things, and about, I think there's 48 in the book. So that's basically how I got the idea. So I was like, you know what, I'm just going to write these however they come out. Some of them are kind of prose poems, some of them are letters, some are whatever, and that is the origin of the Yokohama Three-Way.
Right. And actually, you bring up an interesting point that I wanted to ask you real quick. I like how you said some are written as poems, some are written as letters. Did you find that certain stories just naturally lent themselves to a certain type of writing, or did you just maybe come across those particular styles after maybe experimenting with the particular shames? How did you come up with the particular style?
I had a couple where it started out one way and ended up another way. Some of them are very straightforward. You know, I went to Italy after I graduated from college, you know, whatever, just very kind of storytelling narrative style. And then some of them, like I was trying to write about how awkward it was in the 90s when, like, just a couple, like, sexual incidents where it was like, why were people always playing that Portishead record? Why was that always playing? And then so instead of, like, trying to go into the specifics about the liaisons, I just made it like, you know, public service announcement, don't have sex to a Portishead record. Some people think this is their sex record, you know, and I just made it like this kind of, you know, public service announcement basically about that or whatever. But I tried to write that a different way, and I was just like, why bother? It's just better this way. It's just get to the point, you know.
Nice. Were there any particular shames that were especially hard to revisit or write about?
Yeah, there were a couple. There were a couple that I was like, God, this is, like, there was one about, there's one about how I never defended my older brother when I was growing up. When I went to high school with him, he has cerebral palsy and somewhere on the autism spectrum. And but he went to my high school. He's a senior when I was a freshman, and I used to see these guys, like, making fun of him, imitating his walk, you know, calling him retard. And, you know, as a 14-year-old girl, and these were, like, 18-year-old seniors, I mean, I can see, you know, I can go back there and see why I never said anything, but it's like, Jesus, why didn't I say anything? Like, how could I sit there and watch that? And, like, so that was, that's, like, painful, and that's, like, one of those that just makes me feel so terrible about myself and bad for, you know, all of it, that it just feels bad. And then there were some that were just super embarrassing that I was like, all right, here we go. I'm just going to do it. And so there's a couple in there like that I was like, wow, things that I never told anybody. And I just put it in the book. I mean, like, my husband, I was like, you're going to do some stuff that I've never told you.
I was wondering if you could tell the dog towel story, because I just find that one incredibly hilarious.
So that's also the thing about this book is, like, it inevitably gets you thinking, like, oh, what would my top shame be? You know, and some things that I've done, I'm not ashamed of, and other people would be mortified if it happened to them. And then there are other things that just seem like other people will be like, well, what's the big deal? You know, but it's like one of my top shames, and this is one of them, is being up at this poet's house in Portland. And it was a whole group of us that were going to do a show, and we had just driven up there, so we were all taking a shower before the show, and we're all in this, like, train to get showers and get out of the house. And turned off the shower, and I saw these two stacks of towels, and one stack with these, like, beautiful, colorful, fluffy, like, nice towels, and then there was a rack with these, like, shitty, like, grimy, dirty, you know, gray, thin little towels. And I was like, wow, there's a lot of people here using their bathroom, like, I'll use one of those terrible towels. And so I pull the towel off and I start drying myself off, and then all of a sudden I'm just covered in dog hair, and I smell like the dog, and I have to, like, then return on the shower while everybody's waiting, and then use another towel the next time when I get out. And so I get out, and I'm like, sorry, you guys, I use the dog towel, you know. And the guy who lives there, like, brings everybody into the bathroom and is like, wait a minute. Everybody, look at these two stacks of towels. Here you have these beautiful, fluffy, nice towels, and then you have those towels down there. Who here would choose to dry themselves off of that, just in their own volition, like, pick one of those towels? And I was like, oh, my God, that's so me. Like, that's such my personality that I would be like, hey, just a dog towel for me. I don't need a real towel, you know. So that one's, like, one of the tops. I mean, I just feel like, and that defines me and how terrible that it does, you know. Like, God, don't I feel better about myself than that? I don't know.
Did you find it all that when you were going back on these shameful experiences that, The more shameful the experience, the better story it made, or not necessarily?
Oh, that's interesting. Huh. I wonder, you know what? I feel like things came out that I weren't expecting in some of them, and there were things that, like, I really did try to pick the top ones that were, like, you know, things that really pop up regularly, you know, like, you know, there was a woman once trying to get the in the bathroom, and she was trying to get the faucet to work with those automatic, like, sensors, you know, and the water wouldn't come out, and she was so frustrated, and she went to the other one, and it didn't work, and she then, you know, she was so aggravated, and so I was trying to just be funny, and I was like, whoa, maybe you're invisible. And she just turned around and looked at me, and she was crying already about something else. And she was in her, you know, probably mid-60s, and she was like, you should never tell a woman my age. She's invisible. That's so rude. How do you think I feel in this society? You know, and she just went off and just was yelling at me.
Wow.
And instead of saying, like, oh, my God, I was just making a joke, because she was so angry, I just started laughing because I was nervous or whatever, and I didn't know what to do, And I just, like, walked out without washing my hands, and I laughed, and she was like, what's
wrong with
you?
You grabbed the dog towel and left the bathroom.
I know. Grabbed the dog towel, ran out. But I've thought of that woman literally over 1,000 times in the past, you know, 8 years since that happened. Like, I think of her a lot. And so sometimes there are ones where I'm like, it comes up, and I wasn't expecting it to be such a big deal. And then I'm like, oh, no, that is a big deal, because you've thought of that woman more times than you've thought of people that you actually know in your life, you know? And so that happened definitely, where I just found, I surprised myself by something that was buried, and how when it came out, it really was like, whoa, that felt deep.
Yeah. You know, before you were talking about the self-help book and everything, and you were talking about, you know, people that had come up to you or whatever, in doing readings for Yokohama Three-Way, have you had any people come up to you after readings and share any of their own shames with you?
I've had a couple where people have said, like, oh, my God, that same thing happened to me, or I have that, you know, I did something like that too. Yeah, definitely, definitely. Because it does, I mean, it does get you thinking. Yeah, because we all have those things, you know, things that can just kind of stop you in your tracks, and you're like, oh, my God, that was 20 years ago. Can I just forget it? You know?
Right, right. Well, sort of along the line of the whole self-help idea, I mean, did you find any sort of therapeutic value to writing about these shames? Were there any that you were sort of able to, you know, come to peace with or let go of?
Yeah, I mean, the whole process was way more therapeutic than I thought it was going to be, and I think did me a lot better than a lot more good than the year of self-help did, in a way. Like, because I think that I think by sitting with them all and thinking about them, really, because it's the kind of things that pop up and you try to squash it, you know, whenever you think of it, you're like, oh, God, don't make me remember. I can't go back and remember that time I gave that terrible speech at my brother's wedding or whatever. And so, having to sit there with it really did help me get past a lot of them. And I still do feel like, you know, that is how I define myself as a person. I'm just through my failures and shames and things that are awkward and, you know, and I'm fine with that. You know, I don't feel terrible about myself, but that's kind of, I think it's a huge part of who I am.
Yeah. Yeah. you know, I know there were some stories that either weren't included in the book or that you didn't remember until after the book was completed. Do you think the collection will warrant a follow-up, or do you think you'll just put those shames and stories into another piece of writing?
I don't know. I mean, there's a couple. There are just a few that I thought of, like, oh, shoot, I should have put that in there. But mostly not, because I really did pick the ones that sprang to mind. And I was like, you know what, if they're not big enough that they've repeatedly come into my mind over, you know, the past 20, 25, 30 years, whatever, then it must not be that big of a deal. So I did, I think I really did get the top, but I continue, of course, as we all do, I imagine, you know, to just do embarrassing, regretful things, you know, practically almost every day. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I want to have you read a piece live from the collection, and I believe you're going to read It Girl.
Yeah, I'm going to read this one. And this is one of those ones where it's not really funny and kind of harder to write, but I wanted to write it in a certain way that, let me find it here. Okay. It Girl. It wasn't Dusty, and it wasn't Stevie, and it wasn't Davey, and it wasn't Johnny, and it wasn't Bobby, and it wasn't Mickey, and it wasn't Scotty, and it wasn't Maddie, and it wasn't Jerry, and it wasn't Charlie, but it was a name Ron used to always call me, a name for a boy but worked for a girl. I'd never heard of her, the girl I reminded him of, but some of the old-timers at the bar had. Classic It Girl, he'd say, and then point to me and go, like her, and the drunks would look me up and down, unimpressed. In the morning at work, we'd all be a bit fragile with our coffees and egg sandwiches from Tortilla Flats, and there he would be, reaching down under his desk, room temp PBR that he'd pull up can after can throughout the day from a case at his feet. He'd offer you one, offer anybody one, and in the beginning, we'd all have one. But then, when we'd go to the bar after work, he would nurse his drink, barely touching it, until it looked like everyone was leaving to go somewhere else. I'd turn around and the entire thing would be gone, drained. I found out later that he would buy a pint, go across the street to his apartment, down a couple beers real quick, and then come back. One night at the Fillmore, his girlfriend tried to strangle me. She was a gorgeous blonde with big boobs and a lazy eye. Can you take it? Does it get better than that? And then to have her soft, icy hands wrapped around my throat, squeezing in slow-mo while everyone tried to pull her off. I heard she got sober. One Saturday morning, I had some sort of weird side job and had to be across the city by 7 a.m. The streets in the Mission were mostly empty, but then I saw a lone figure walking back from the all-night Safeway with a case of PBR on his shoulder. Was he up already or still up? I told myself I didn't stop to give him a ride because I didn't want to embarrass him, but I know he wouldn't have cared. He would have been happy to see me. The reason I didn't stop is because I didn't want him in my car. I saw my friend walking down the street, and I sank back into my hoodie and cruised right past him. I spoke at his memorial, held in a dive bar during the day, which was appropriate and depressing, appropriately depressing. Whose idea was that? But I guess where else was it supposed to be? We all had pints, and what I wanted to say to everyone gathered was, I'm glad. I'm glad I don't have to get into his rental car that smells like barf and watch his nose and cheeks turning into an Andy Capp comic and pretend to be excited to run into him or try to understand what he's saying and then give him a hug to shut him up. Aren't you all glad you don't have to give him a hug to shut up his drunken mouth anymore? Dead at 38 from his internal organs busting into liquid and coming out his holes. Or maybe that's just how I... And what was that name he always called me? I was up late Googling, but couldn't put in the right combination of words to riddle it right, so I lay in bed scrolling through the names of all the boys I'd ever met until I finally got to Joe. Joey. That's who I reminded him of. Joey Heatherton was her name. She had nice legs and starred in a provocative Serta mattress commercial in the 70s. She's still alive.
That's wow. It. That's beautiful. That was Beth Lissick reading It Girl from her latest collection, Yokohama Three-Way and Other Small Shames. Beth, sort of on this theme of the Beth Lissick sampler, I want to go get in the Wayback Machine. Well, not Wayback, but talk a little about your spoken word and how you got into spoken word, into slamming and touring.
Uh-huh.
And if tell that story.
Yeah, so as I was saying a little earlier, like I didn't write in college except for sometimes I would, overhear a conversation on the bus that I thought was funny or weird, or I would, think of something like, oh, what if there was a character who did this, and I would just write down something like a little scratch of paper, but I never did anything with them. And then when I happened to be in a bar during an open mic night and saw people getting on the stage and reading these very short pieces, I thought, oh, that's what I can do. I can try doing that, And so I came back the very next week with something I'd just written, and I really liked it. And I realized that I wasn't scared of speaking in public, even though I'd never done it before. And I cared what people thought, but I also didn't. I liked the way that you could just kind of slip back into the dark bar afterwards. I mean, that's mostly the open mics I went to were the ones in bars and that started later and just felt like you were really anonymous. And this is in, 93, I guess, when I started. And so then I was just like, hooked on it. I loved doing it. I wrote everything to just be performed on stage and didn't think of how anything would ever look on a page, or I never imagined any of it would ever be published. It just seemed like, wow, this is really cool. You can go into the bar and you meet all these weird people and everybody does their thing and it's a bunch of freaks. And I loved it. And I made a lot of good friends. And I guess after that, I met Gary Glazner, who was one of the poets in San Francisco who was involved in the first national poetry slam. And he was the one who was like, oh, you should do this thing. It's really fun. You can go to a different city and meet other poets. And so that's kind of how that started. And the poetry slam in the beginning in San Francisco was, it was a joke. It was like it was like in an art gallery where like they would have an orgy afterwards. It's just like so weird, and nobody, sometimes they couldn't get enough judges, and people just sort of laughed at it. So that's how I started doing that. And I mostly just really liked the people that I met. And I did poetry slam for a couple of years, and then stopped doing that, but was still performing. But I kind of got burned out on the it just seemed like there was also a lot of, you know, people like really perfecting their performances in a way that just felt untrue to me. Like, I just was like, aren't you bored of yourself? Because I'm bored of myself. I can't imagine doing that for like the, you know, 15th time with the exact same inflection and pauses and, you know, and it's a different thing. You know, it's more theater. And I just, I felt like, oh, I just liked it when it was like a kind of off the hinges and you didn't know where it was going to go. So that's why I stopped that. But I, you know, I kept performing and then I had that band that where I would do spoken word and stuff like that.
Yeah. You know, I want to get back to the spoken word and there are a couple more questions I want to ask you about.
Oh, yeah, sure.
In that regard. But I actually want to go back to the It Girl story for a second because, you know, that was a really beautiful piece. And you know, something that came to mind for me is like, you know, when you see someone in your community, whether it's music or writing or, you know, just drinking buddies or whatever, and you see, you know, one person in particular who is just particularly, you know, and I loved how you described it, you know, just destroying themselves with you know, with booze or whatever. I mean, there's a certain compassion that goes out to that person and a love and a want to try to save them. But then that's sort of mixed with this feeling of like, dude, you are fucking up big time, you know? And I mean, it sounds like there was a mixture of that for you to some degree or another. And I'm curious how you sort of kind of dealt with those kind of conflicting emotions when either seeing this go down in person or when writing the story.
Yeah, I mean, I think in writing that, it was the first time that I really was like, God, what a horrible feeling to be relieved when somebody, when a friend dies. Like, and I just remember being at that feeling at that memorial where we were all just in this gross, dirty bar that he liked, you know, during the day, drinking, you know, the way that he killed himself. And I just felt like, this is disgusting. This is like, I felt like, you know, there are a lot of people, a lot of us had done stuff over the years to try to help them, of course. And so I think that, like, with that piece, I decided for the kind of central focus point to just be, like, give a little bit of my relationship with him and that we were, you know, coworkers and we were friendly. And, but that, like, what an awful feeling to just be like, phew, you know, he's out of my life. And how I used to, you know, whenever I would see him, I would just take a deep, big, you know, and you know how that is, like people like that, you see him come and you're like, okay, here we go, you know, and it's so, it feels so selfish to, you're like, this person is destroying themselves, they're hurting, they're obviously in a horrible place, we've all tried to do stuff and you just sort of, you give up, but they're still alive, and so you're still dealing with them, and yeah, it's rough. And, you know, being around the artists and writers and musicians and stuff, you know, there's a lot of people, especially being, I'm 40, almost 45 now, and it's like, you know, so I've seen a lot of people go one way or the other, and I've seen a lot of friends get sober, and that's so incredible. I'm seeing their writing just get amazing, you know, after they're not hooked up anymore, and that's always good too, right? So there's that side of it as well. But it was there were so many crazy characters around in the beginning, and I think it's just it's hard to write about other people's, you know, you can't write about other people's experiences when you're doing stuff like this. And I just felt like, God, it's so weird to, I'm just going to put it through my kind of filter of what it was like to be around him and see him do that.
Yeah, it's rough. You know, getting back to the idea of spoken word and performing and everything. So, you know, you've written for, we'll call it the stage, you've written for performance. You've also written books. How would you say maybe that your writing for performance, for spoken word, helped you when you started writing, you know, for the page, and what were certain points where you sort of maybe said to yourself, okay, these have to be two different types of writing now to one degree or another?
Yeah, it's weird because I did so much of my editing, like my first book was basically just a collection of all these things that I was reading at the open mics. And
that
so
was
when
on,
it came
that
to
was
put
on
that together,
Manatee, right?
That's right, yeah. So Jennifer Joseph came to
Jennifer
me, and
Joseph.
She ran a she ran a open mic Sunday nights at the Paradise Lounge for years and years and years, and that's where I did a lot of readings. And you know, I would edit myself. Like, I would read something, say, there on Sunday night, and then I'd go to the Chameleon Bucky Sinister reading on Monday night, and I'd change it and edit it, you know, and read it a little and say, oh, okay, that worked better. So I was doing something, but it was more editing for performance. And then I, it was kind of a weird transition to write something knowing, all right, this is for a book, you know, this is something that's going to appear in print, and what does that look like? And so it was definitely, I think, a learning curve. And even now, like with this book, all these years later, there's just ones that work better out loud. And if I know I'm going to read to a packed bar, I'm going to pick, you know, from the 10 or 15 of them I think that work really well live. And I'm, so there's that part of me that is really present still, that I want to be, you know, I want to be entertaining, and I want it to sound good, and I want it to be, have some element of excitement and drama or comedy or something when I'm in front of people, because I definitely feel the, I don't know, I try to do something, you know, what would I want to see? Oh, I'd want to see somebody, you know, doing something that feels really dynamic and at this reading, and I think that because of part of who I am, you know, it's like I can't help it. Like I have to go to those pieces, you know, and there are huge sections of you know, my other books that I'll just never read aloud, because I'm like, well, that doesn't work at all. Who wants, you know? And then I think, well, is that good writing? Like, if I don't feel like reading it out loud, is that even good writing? I mean, you know, I trust that it's okay, but sometimes I think that, I really do. I'm like, well, if I don't want to read it out loud, who's going to want to read it? Maybe I should, you know, I don't know. So it's a weird thing, but it's definitely something I think about all the time. And I always edit by reading aloud.
Yes, yeah, so do I, actually, and I'm glad you do that. And it makes sense, because you're a performer, because that's actually where I get some of my best editing done. Because if I find that I'm tripping up on words or certain things, or if I'm even boring, if there's a passage of my work where I'm starting to nod off, it's like, okay, we got to look at this a little bit more closely.
Yeah, definitely. I know, it's so funny. It's like, I think that there's a... I am mostly almost entirely conversational when I write, and you know, with the exception of if I'm doing something that feels more poetic or something like that, but I do like to be really conversational too. And so if I'm writing and I think, like, oh, you know, this word will go really, like, this is the exact word that I need, like, I have to kind of think about it, like, all right, are you going to use that, you know, kind of bigger word that you don't use in everyday conversation? And I go half and half sometimes. Sometimes I'll use it because it's the perfect word, but I'll think, wow, it's a funny word because I know what that word means, and this is exactly what I want to use, but I never use that word when I'm talking. And so that I stopped with those kind of things too.
Right. Well, you know, that conversational quality, I'm glad this came up, because it kind of relates to something we were talking about earlier. I love that conversational quality of your writing, because it sort of feels like almost like you're there in the room. I mean, just like you said earlier, when you get up on the stage, you're sort of better now at sort of being the Beth Lissick, or getting closer to being the Beth Lissick that's you off stage. And I get that kind of vibe in your book form too. So I think that's a really good quality. It's quite admirable.
Yeah, thank you.
Sort of very early on in your career, you know, you have the two books with Manic D, Monkey Girl, and This Too Can Be Yours. And then, if I'm not mistaken, you also had a piece selected for Best American Poetry. I mean, was there a point early on for you where you're like, oh yeah, I'm set, or were you left wondering, oh, okay, what do I do now?
I think, you know, the Best American Poetry thing is funny, because that poem, which I never had thought of as a poem, right? It was something that I wrote to read out at the bar when everybody was drunk. And so I never thought of it as a poem. And that was my first published, that came out before Monkey Girl. That was my first published poem ever. So when that happened and when it got put into that anthology, I actually thought, you know what, this is great because I didn't think of it as a poem, and this means, guess what, there's no rules. You have no idea what's happening. Nobody knows what's going on. You know, and that to me made me want to write more because I just thought,
oh, good.
You know, like, so it wasn't anything of like, because I'm not an academic, you know, I'm not in the academic world, and so it wasn't like, oh, this is really, now I'm going to get on the tenure track at my year, you know, or now, you know, I'm going to be, people are going to want me to read poetry all over the world because, you know, it was more just like, whoa, okay, oh, okay, then really that's a poem, James Tate? Okay, great. You know, and I'm just going to keep writing them because there's this huge freedom and there's no way to do it and there's no way to get, there's no one way to be accepted or to be thought of as good or bad, or, you know, it's like you can kind of go about things your own way. And so that was actually really huge. I saw this panel at AWP last year on James Tate that Jeffrey McDaniel was leading, and he was like, you know, I don't know if he said it or somebody on the panel was like, you know, James Tate is a huge permission giver, and I loved that because I just thought, man, that's how I want to think of myself, that way, like doing the Porchlight series, getting people up on stage who normally don't talk in front of groups, and like that idea of just like, because I think that coming from a place where I really thought like, you've got to be so full of yourself to think anybody would care what you have to say, it's nice to get that little nudge and have somebody be like, no, this is good, you can just be another voice out there too, like there's millions of voices, just be one. And so that was kind of it for me, that was the main thing that kind of kept me writing then.
Yeah. How did the piece get into the book? Did someone hear you read it? Was the piece published somewhere?
Yeah. James Tate heard me read it, and
oh, wow.
it was funny because, and that's funny too, right? Like, you know, it wasn't like this thing where I sent it off and it was in a literary magazine, and then they're like, very nice. You know, it was like, it was at a cocktail party at a writer's conference in Birmingham that Jennifer Joseph couldn't go to because she was pregnant. And so she sent me, because she was going to be publishing my book. And so we were, me and Bucky Sinister, and I think it was, Jeff McDaniel, who I just mentioned, we were like the entertainment at the cocktail party, you know? And so it's like all these people standing around, and they're like, let's get these spoken word kids to do their jazzy thing, you know, or whatever. And,
right.
So I read that, and, you know, I read like 3 to 4 things, and that was one of them. And then afterwards, James Tate was like, that was a great poem. He's like, I'm not bamboozled by all your flashy stage. He's like, that was a good poem. And there was somebody also there who ran a journal called the Clock Watch Review that was in out of Chicago, and he said, this is so funny, because James Tate said, I really want to look at that on the page. You know, I'm editing Best American Poetry this year. And the other guy, I can't remember his name, his last name is Platt, and he said, well, you know, we're about to go to press with our review, so you could, I guess, to be in those anthologies that have to appear somewhere else, and then they pull it out and, you know, put it in there. So the one guy, you know, they looked at it, and they're like, great, let's go. I mean, it was so funny and weird, and it was a thing about gated communities, which is a bunch of street names in it, you know, like it just starts out like, take a left on Palm Canyon until you reach Desert Falls, bear left at the fork of Indian Canyon and Canyon Plaza, taking Desert Canyon to Canyon Sands. Like, it was just kind of this ridiculous sort of almost Bongwater-esque, like, kind of trip through the weird Palm Springs area. And he just thought it was funny and weird, and, you know, he's a weird guy, and so anyway, that's how it happened.
Well, that's funny because just even what you sort of just said right there, it's funny how, you know, sort of, for lack of a better word, the poetry of the everyday. You know, you can take, you know, you can take street names or whatever like that, and if you are savvy enough, like you were obviously, to sort of put them together in a certain way, you can even just put things like that together, and it's like, wow, that's really cool.
Yeah, yeah, and I was like, okay, really? That's about, yeah, because all I'm thinking is like, oh, this is so weird. These are directions. So they were actually directions to John Sherba's mom and stepdad's house, just to bring it back to John Sherba. And yeah, and that's when, you know, we were visiting them, and I was writing down all the street names, going, God, this is so weird. And, yeah, and that's also, yeah, why it was funny to me learning, because I hadn't studied writing, and just being like, oh, really, that's a poem, and okay, and there is something about, yeah, how you put it together, and it's like, okay, cool, that's great, let's do more of that.
Yeah, yeah, well, well done. You know, you did a spoken word piece for SF MoMA in conjunction with a Calder retrospective. I was hoping you could talk a little about the piece, a little about the experience, and then I want to play the piece.
Yeah, okay, so this is something that they were having this big Calder retrospective, and they wanted to do something where they were, you know, taking people from the San Francisco arts community and getting them to respond to the exhibition. And when I had this band called the Bethlehemic Ordeal, I was doing, you know, all the music, all my pieces were kind of in this very spoken word style, and everything was very, you know, dramatic, and I had lots of laughs and whatever. And I just thought, God, I want to do something with music that's not that. Like, I want to do something that's really mellow, because it was all, again, like the band, it was all for performance. You know, it was like, I want to put on a fun show. And so for this, it was just a recorded project that I did with my husband. And I had read about that after he had had it, Calder had had a big retrospective in New York. He died, like, within days afterwards. And I just thought, God, what a trip. Like, he must have come home from his show. And how was he feeling after having this, you know, huge show, and who did he live with, and he did so many cool things, and so I just wanted to kind of imagine that I was talking to him right before he died, when he was just, like, laying on the couch at his apartment in New York.
Wow. Wow. And the name of the piece is?
Ha. Huh. You know what? I don't know if we ever named it. I don't know if we ever named it. That's so funny. It's,
yeah, because I was looking to find the name here, and it's like, I don't have a name for it.
Yeah, that's so funny, because we basically just delivered it to them, and they, you know, they had it up at the show, and yeah, so it doesn't have even a title. My untitled conversation with Alexander Calder.
That's a beautiful title right there. Why don't we go ahead and play it?
Okay, cool.
Oh, my God, he must be exhausted. Kind of in a good way, right? Not like a chronic fatigue thing, but why don't you just lay down for a bit? Here, let me take your shoes off for you. I'm going to order Chinese. I thought it was great. All of it. The whole thing. Almost everybody does, because you're not forcing, you know, it just, it all comes across perfectly natural for some reason. Did you want to put on some sweatpants or anything? Your head's a little hot. Okay. You're the one who's always been good with accents, but you need to tell me the Marcel Duchamp story again, because I never get it right. I was trying to tell the girl at the gym the other day, but every time I try to do an accent, it comes out sounding Scottish, you know, and it's one of those things where you need the right accent for it. The best part is when you get to I can't do it justice, but every time you get to the part where Kiki de Montparnasse comes in, and then she looks at her portrait for the first time, the wire one, you know, oh my God, I mean, Miro is losing it. So, this girl asked me what you did, and I just said, oh, you made necklaces and painted jet airplanes. I mean, it's true, you did. But I was thinking, how can I explain, you know, the sheet metal and wire, the glass, the wood, the bronze, you know, the strings, those balls, those constellations, flexible towers being blown around, springing and circling, rotating, you know, is that an amoeba or a lady? I don't know. The crinkly little machines, the toys, some hairy prickly bulb of a thing, bone, sea creature, flower, jacaranda, spiral, circuit. What was the thing that Sartre said about the mobiles? You know, a little private celebration, I think. That's what we're having tonight, right? Are you sleeping, Earth? All right, I'll wake you up when the food gets here. Man, you had a lot of fun.
And that was Beth Lissick reading her beautiful piece at the for the Calder Retrospective at the San Francisco MoMA. You know, Beth, getting back to that whole idea of conversational quality, when I first heard this piece, you know, I was almost startled, not startled, but I was really struck by the intimacy of it. I mean, it really, the intimacy of it really comes across. And did that just come naturally when you were recording it?
I think because I was picturing it, that I was writing for, you know, a lady who knew him, imagining somebody who knew him really well, and that they were in his apartment and he was laying down, he was possibly wearing sweatpants, which I just enjoyed picturing, like Cedric Calder in sweatpants. And so I just kind of pictured her kind of sitting, you know, kind of sitting on the couch as he's lying there, just sort of like stroking his head and talking to him. And yeah, I definitely pictured a scene where it would have, the voice would have been really quiet, and maybe he wasn't feeling well because it was right before he died, and so I just pictured it kind of like that.
Yeah, you know, speaking of people passing away, I saw a little earlier that Lou Reed has gotten into his Satellite of Love and sailed away. I was so like, wow.
I know, I had heard that he wasn't in the best health, but I mean, I know, I just feel like, and it's funny how the older you get, like I'm just like, 71, that's not old enough, you know, like I don't know, and I thought of Laurie Anderson, and yeah, heavy.
Yeah.
R.I.P. Lou.
Yeah, well, sort of while on the music performance topic for a moment, we've got a few more minutes. I was hoping you could maybe, I mean, this is where I'm going to sort of kind of just jump around to some different things. I was hoping you could talk a little about the origins of Sister Spit, how that came about, and maybe, you know, one of your, a memorable tour story or something.
Yeah. So Sister Spit started in the 90s in San Francisco by the writer Michelle T., and Cindy Anderson, who's now a filmmaker and just made a documentary about Kathleen Hanna that just is playing around right now. And they were sort of reacting to the very male-centric open mic scene in San Francisco, which was true. There were tons of dudes, and they're both queer women, and they were just like, we need to make like a space just for women to do their thing, and like let's start this thing called Sister Spit. And so I loved their writing and, you know, liked them, and so just met them through being around and would go read at Sister Spit, which was that was also on Sundays. And then Michelle basically says, you know, she wanted to tour around. She's like, why can't a group of poets and writers tour around like a rock band does? Like, well, let's all get together in a van, you know, get a couple vans and do this. So we went on these tours that were insane. The first one, I think, was in 96 or 97. And, you know, 30-city tours, I mean, booked before the internet, before cell phones, you know, punk rock style, where you would go and, I mean, we would do these shows and be up on stage being like, all right, if anybody has a place, we can crash, you know, and there were like 8 or 10 of us or something. And so that, you know, that was so much fun. And also, you know, introduced me to just some of my favorite people to this day. And so then after a couple years, they took a break from doing it. And then now Michelle has revamped Sister Spit in the past few years. And actually my book on City Lights is her imprint. So they gave her her own imprint to edit. So it's City Lights, Sister Spit. And and I'm going on tour with those guys in March for a month.
Oh,
so we're
going to
do it again. But it's funny now because now we do it and we have actually like decent vans and places to stay, and you know, it's more, it's a little more pro. I mean, we were such a mess back then. I mean, oh my God, I have a piece of
that,
I have a couple things in my book from that.
Google Maps.
Yeah, I know. I mean, you can, you know, call your contact on the way to the show. I mean, we would drive up, you know, pull into Athens, Georgia, and just be like, does anybody know where this women's cafe is, you know, whatever. And I mean, it's so funny. Oh, my God. And, yeah, so, yeah, there was one, I have one really short, I have a couple pieces in the book, but about touring, but this is probably just says it best, better than me, like going on about it. It's like one paragraph. Can I read it? It's really
short.
Yeah,
please do.
Okay, it's called Pig. Finney and I woke up in the tour van, which was parked on the back lawn of some communal living space in Atlanta. All the doors were thrown open because it was August and already so sticky, even before the sun came blasting in on us. I thought about the woman at that bar last night crushing the beer cans between her boobs when we heard a noise, a grunt. We looked outside and saw an enormous pig wandering into the house where everybody else was sleeping. Inside the house, a friend skittered out from a bedroom with duct tape all over her wrists and ankles. It was probably smart to have slept in the van. How had we ended up parked on that back lawn anyway? Cindy thought I drove. I thought she did. So, I mean, there was a lot of boozing and losing, you know, like,
right,
it was,
right.
I mean, we were nuts, you know, we were in our 20s, we were sleeping at communal living spaces that had pigs and people into sex games using duct tape, you know, I mean, it was just crazy,
right.
You know, just anything that you can imagine happened, like, it was really chaotic and crazy, and now most of those people are also sober as well, but back then it was sort of a free-for-all.
Yeah. We're getting close to the end of our time, but I want
okay.
to, are there any particular projects you're working on, any new things you're working on that you want to talk,
you know,
about
going,
or anything?
No, I'm going back to that novel that I had started before. So that's my writing project right now. And then this web series that I'm doing is in the midst of getting edited, called Rods and Cones. And that's just like wig and glasses, naked humor, you know, just
Is that with
really
Tara Jepsen?
Yeah. And she lives in L.A., so we do a lot of writing across the continent. And but we filmed it all in L.A. last summer. And so that's coming out. And then, yeah.
Well, speaking of...
Speaking
of kind of being all over the place, you know, you've lived in the Bay Area for years. You're in Brooklyn now. What's life like for you? I mean, how do you like Brooklyn living? How would you say it compares to, you know, Bay Area and that sort of thing?
You know, I did the thing at my age that a lot of people do a lot earlier in their lives, which is move away from the place you're from. And the Bay Area is so great and gave me so much for so many years. I got so much out of it that it was really hard to move away from there. But at the same time, I'm super happy to I got really creatively energized being somewhere new. And it's funny because I don't really know, and you know, many people here. I know who some writers are and I can go to readings, but I'm definitely not part of any kind of community here. And that's really funny, and it's weird to be in that place. And I think after being so deeply embedded in the Bay Area arts community for 20 years, it actually feels really good to just kind of be more of an observer, an outsider, and I really like it. And I, you know, live in a neighborhood where I walk around with a car for the first time since I was 16 years old. It's just, you know, it's great. It's a good, it's been good for me creatively and personally. It's a lot more mellow. Not many people move to New York to mellow out, but for me, it's been a lot more kind of calming, centering, mellow thing where I just sort of have my, you know, my world is very small here, and but I can still take in, you know, all the readings and art and music and everything, but yeah, it's a lot quieter for me here.
And I believe your husband's working at a recording studio there or something like that?
Yeah, it's actually being built in our building right now, so he's been working out of other studios while this one's being built. But that's kind of why we came here, is that his friend was building the studio and there was an apartment available in the building, so it was sort of, you know, an easy transplant in that way. And he actually mixed the last Kathleen Hanna record, her band, The Julie Ruin, that just came out. And, you know, then that's kind of a weird confluence. I find that as I get older, all my circles of people kind of start getting closer and closer and closer together. Even this, Rich, we must have met almost 20 years ago, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, I love that, you know. That's one of the amazing thing about getting older is you have these people in your life for so long and they're all off doing all their stuff and you get to come together in these ways. And so, it's so great to be talking to you right now. I mean, I met you through Jim and John and all those guys.
I know, and I'm so happy that that you wanted to be on the show, because you're right. It's like, it's just, you know, I've sort of like, you know, charted your progress over the years and super happy
and
for you and just super excited. With the recording studio in such close proximity, or at least once it's finished being built, do you think that'll maybe get you doing more music? Or
I don't know. You know, we just contributed this songs to this Bob Dylan cover record that Eli played on it, and I did it. We did Tombstone Blues, and it was so fun. And we're going to do another one for a woman, Elizabeth Early, who has a book coming out next year, and she's putting together like a CD compilation or whatever, musical compilation of pieces inspired by her book. And so I'm doing something with Eli for that. And yeah, so maybe I will. I mean, I really like it, and you know, I don't play any instruments, but I love doing stuff with words and music, and I'll, you know, hopefully be able to get to do more.
Cool. Well, we're about at the end of our time. What's the best way for people to find out about you online or to get your books?
Oh yeah, the book you can order through City Lights on their website, and then I have a website, BethLissick.com, that just has some basic links and stuff like that. I keep it pretty mellow over there, but have some, you know, readings and stuff like that. And yeah, that's how it's very in this world, very easy to find out with the Google.
Great. Well, thank you again, Beth, for being on the show, and much continued success to you and your family and everything. I also want to send out a big thank you to our show sponsor for all your writerly needs. Please contact Tyson Cornell and the lovely Julia at Rare Bird Lit. You can find them online at rarebirdlit.com. Also, a big thanks to Tyson Cornell for production assistance with today's show. Poetescape's theme music is by We Voice Sing. You can find them online at wevoicesing.com. You can find their debut CD of Wishbones and Gunfire on CD Baby, iTunes, Rhapsody, and Spotify. You can find me online at wevoicesing.com, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram. You can find my poetry collection, Eighth in Agony, on Amazon or at Punk Hostage Press. Tune in next week when my guest will be New York City poet, performer, and founder of Uphook Press for Media, Ms. Jane Ormerod. Until then, I'm Rich Ferguson, and thanks for tuning in to Poetescape.